You ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell, and I am here representing the respondent's position on the certified questions to this court from the Superior Court concerning the constitutionality of House Bill 190. Now, the legal principles are familiar to the court. I'll recite them briefly. It's not all of the void for vagueness doctrine, which we claim makes this statute unconstitutional. It's a very unique situation here, and it's differentiated from the ordinary vagueness doctrine. And that's because penalty comes into play here. Not just punishment, but the quantum of punishment affects, we believe, the standard of review insofar as whether the statute is vague or not.
Don't we have to address these questions in reverse order? In other words, to answer the constitutionality question, don't we have to first decide whether there is a state of mind requirement or not?
Yes and no. Okay. The state claims there's not a state of mind requirement, but then again claims there is a state of mind requirement of negligence. That's qualitative because what kind of negligence?
Let me be more specific. The 251 issue.
The 251 issue. If it can be decided on that ground, yes, we don't reach the constitutional question.
And but you concede then that if 251 applies, that it is constitutional?
No. No.
Why do we not get to
No, it requires, it says it requires a state of mind for imposition of criminal culpability under these circumstances that is greater than ordinary negligence or even less than ordinary negligence. And one of the problems here is in the void for vagueness doctrine comes into play when persons may differ as to the application of the statute. And that's what's a problem here. And it's whether the statute can be enforced in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement under Colander versus Lawson. Now, the state, we argue here that 4176A provides consequences unforeseen by the legislature and allows discriminatory enforcement. And if we look at the Senate debate that the state provided in the as an exhibit to its answering brief, we contend that that becomes clear. The state represented that the conduct underlying the passage of this legislation known as the Warren G. Pritchett Bill, in honor of the man who was killed by the defendant in this action while he was riding a bicycle along a Kent County rural roadway. The state suggested the legislature, in fact, told the legislature that part of the problem was this, is that there was a gap in the law, that insofar as this defendant's conduct was not prosecutable, really, because there was no penalty but a small fine available. In this case, the defendant hit Mr. Pritchett in broad daylight on a clear, unobstructed country road. Afterwards, his daughter was told by police and prosecutors that the man who drove his truck into Abby Reichert's father while he rode his bicycle on a rural country road might well have hit a mailbox. They could only convict him of careless driving. Hitting your father, this quote, hitting your father was no different than hitting a mailbox, she recalled him saying. That's from both the Delaware State News and the News Journal. Now,
are we supposed to look at those newspapers to find out what the legislature intended?
I think it's fair to consider that because, after all, it's the public who is subject to legislation and the prescriptions of legislation and the penalties imposed by legislation. So how the public perceives that is important. And the court, you know, is in the position of looking at just how the general public would perceive this legislation and how it can be applied.
Well, if we got into the business of trying to determine how the general public would determine the plain meaning of a statute, to the extent statutes have plain meanings, and occasionally they do, wouldn't we be invading the legislative prerogative?
No, I don't think so. because I think the legislature wanted to pass a statute that the public would understand. Doesn't mean they did. It doesn't mean they necessarily understood all of its applications or ramifications themselves.
It's fair to say the legislature would want to pass a statute that the public applauded. Where does understanding come into it?
Where does understanding come into it? Well, they would want something to be clear, and they would want something to be passed that was applied as they intended. And if it leaves enough room...
Doesn't this statute provide that if you violate any part of the motor vehicle law and a death follows, you're going to get potentially an extra punishment?
Yes. Possibly severe punishment.
What's unclear about that?
Well, the state contends in its answering brief, and we have to concede this is correct, insofar as vagueness, if you look at a statute, say, operating a vehicle with a taillight out or a signaling lamp out, if it causes an accident, what's vague about that? Your signal was out. Well, they're correct. Or you're speeding. Or you didn't see a stop sign and you go through it. What's vague about that? You're correct. But the penalties for that are fines or possibly a small term of imprisonment of 30 days if you're a repeat offender.
No, but let's assume now, I mean, the law's on the books, and what we now have is everyone who takes driver's education and gets their driver's license is not only told, here are the motor vehicle laws, but, in addition, if you violate any one of them and a death follows, you're going to subject yourself to an enhanced penalty.
The difficulty is I don't think under the circumstances the public says would appreciate that because it's vague as to its application. And there are other problems with it, says, too, that basically no courts have addressed.
Can you explain to me how it's vague, as you put it, as to its application?
Well, it'll take some time. That was my objective.
17 minutes and 48 seconds.
That's my objective, Your Honor. I hope I accomplished that. During the General Assembly debate, for instance, Senator McDowell brought up, what about an improper lane change that kills a motorcyclist? Well, there are various factors thrown in. What if the motorcyclist is speeding? What if he was not? But even if the motorcyclist was not speeding, was in the defendant's blind spot, and someone made a turn and caused the death of that motorcyclist.
Why would contributory negligence have anything to do with it? As I understand the statute, the mens rea is taken from whatever the motor vehicle violation is that underlies the conduct that resulted in a death. So if it's an unauthorized lane change, and you change lanes without a signal or where you shouldn't cross a double line, what does the other person's conduct have to do with it at all?
Well, I'm going to try to explain that in some depth.
Because you can cause a death just by contributing to it. You don't have to be the sole proximate cause.
I understand, says that, and that's another says problem with the statute. But part of the problem is the randomness of the result. That is part of the problem here. People commit motor vehicle violations all says the time, frequently. Very seldom does it result in a criminal penalty of imprisonment. And that's where we get into that, and I'd like to discuss a little bit, says later, the lottery situation.
Well, but when we do that, just help me make sure I understand the record. And that is that with respect to this possibility of a greater punishment, there is no minimum mandatory. Is that correct?
No, there's not.
So what we're talking about here is that we simply give a sentencing judge an opportunity to impose a greater sentence depending on the facts and circumstances of each individual case.
True. And at its outer limits, and we've reached those outer limits in this case, that can present problems.
Well, there wouldn't,
we can define.
There wouldn't ever be a circumstance, would there, under which someone made an improper lane change that killed a motorcyclist where the judge would simply fine them $35 in cost?
I don't know. It's possible previously. Depends upon, says, the prosecution.
Well, but if the statute says it causes the death of another person, it's punishable by not more than 30 months. Now, while that doesn't mandate mm-hmm. a minimum mandatory,
sure.
under truth in sentencing, how could a trial judge give somebody simply a $35 fine under those circumstances? They'd have to impose some imprisonment, wouldn't they? Isn't there a truth in sentencing guideline?
I believe the statute says up to 30 months imprisonment.
Well, that's what the statute says, but in order to have conformity among trial judges under mm-hmm. similar circumstances, wouldn't there be a truth in sentencing guideline?
Well, I know from experience in truth in sentencing guidelines, when you walk into a courtroom with a vehicular homicide and you can have a prosecutor's recommendation of a certain sentence, and you can have your truth in sentencing guidelines, which identify that sentence as being appropriate, and you also face with a situation where the victim's family gives an impassioned statement of how grievously they've been injured by the defendant's behavior, it's not unusual that the sentence imposed will be twice that of the sentence recommended by the state or called for under the sentencing guidelines.
Well, but the trial judge would put on the record his or her reasons for deviating from the guidelines. And my only question here is, as a practical matter, can you conceive of a circumstance under which a trial judge, given the import of this statute, would ever consider imposing nothing more than the same penalty for a simple improper lane change without a death resulting?
It's possible. Anything's possible, as under the statute.
Okay.
I may be jumping the gun here, but I'm a little bit confused. In a situation where somebody's driving improperly and changes lanes and hits a motorcycle and causes the motorcyclist's death, you've got a connection between the motor vehicle violation and the death. What about a situation where a person's taillight is out? That's a motor vehicle violation, right?
Correct.
And they're driving along at exactly the speed limit, paying careful attention, and somebody runs out into the road, and this person attempts to miss the person, the pedestrian, but is unsuccessful, mm-hmm. hits the pedestrian and kills the pedestrian. Isn't that person potentially going to be sentenced to 30 months in prison for that conduct?
Correct.
Without there being any connection between the motor vehicle violation and the death?
Correct. And
how does that square as a matter of constitutional law?
I'd say it's impermissible because
Why?
The statute permits it. Why?
Well, how
because
does the statute permit it? The key word in the statute is cause. Mm-hmm. And under Justice Berger's hypothetical, maybe I'm not getting it, but I don't see any causal relationship.
That's right.
There could be, says a causal, says relationship. There could be a causal relationship under different circumstances where a taillight is burned out and someone rear-ends you.
Let me give you a fact.
And kills the backseat passenger.
Let me give you a fact situation that is not actually hypothetical because it formed the basis for one of an underinsurance, uninsured claim. A vehicle goes through a stop sign illegally, strikes another vehicle, causes an accident. Across the highway, someone sees where the accident has occurred. There's a body lying in the roadway. Person uninvolved in the collision gets out of their vehicle, goes across the road to help the person whose body is in the highway. A car comes and strikes that person and kills him. The argument was that it was the original driver who went through the stop sign that caused that death. Is that potentially a fact situation that could bring this statute into play, even though the person who actually struck and killed them was the person coming across the highway the other way? But the argument was the accident that caused him to get out of his car to be a good Samaritan in part caused his death, if not proximately caused his death.
Yes, and I'm prepared to cite, based upon cases this court has considered, other cases the court has considered, that that is permissible under the statute. And furthermore, it's going on.
Two people could be prosecuted.
Exactly.
For that death.
Here's an indictment. Returned January 8th of Yin Wang and Norma Stinchicum. Now, this accident occurred in Kirkwood Highway, Route 2 and Route 41, Newport Gap Pike. What happened was Miss Stinchicum, I'm sorry, I have a cold and I'm dry because of antihistamines. Ms. Finchicum was operating a vehicle and turned left on the Newport Gap Pike as her arrow was turning, says yellow. Meanwhile, traffic was proceeding, says eastbound on Kirkwood Highway. All the vehicles came to a stop except for one, a school bus driven by Yin Wang. The school bus disregarded the red light and struck the vehicle operated by Ms. Finchicum in the passenger side. Her passenger, who was her paramour or significant other of several years, both she and the decedent were in their 60s, he was killed in a school bus as a result of this accident. The state has indicted both Yin Wang, the school bus driver, and Mrs. Finchicum for failure to yield. This statute permits these possibilities. And this is what is happening. Now, one of the things that the state pointed out was to the legislature is there's a gap in the law, and we have
Can
to fill it.
Yes. Stop you again because I'm getting very confused. Am I reading this correctly? A person is guilty of operation of a vehicle causing death when, in the course of driving in violation of any provision, the person's driving causes the death of another person. So, getting back to my taillight problem, you can have a violation because you've got a broken taillight, but the broken taillight is not what caused the accident. It's your driving, which has nothing to do with the broken taillight, and your driving caused the accident only in the sense that you've hit somebody who ran out in front of you on the road.
Right.
And am I correct that that would meet the requirements of the statute?
That would not meet the requirements of the statute.
Why?
But just with a little bit of
a
factual difference, if your taillights are out, they go out, and you're rear-ended, and as a result of your...
Tell me why my scenario doesn't meet...
Because it's not a... It's not... Doesn't meet the proximate cause but for.
Where's that?
Test. Well, it's... The state argued that not only the but for cause was required, but the Bullock... causation says requirement was required.
Wait. Back up. I'm not that fast. Where in the statute is there a but-for requirement?
The state is arguing that it's required, I assume, to make it constitutional.
But answer what I've asked you. Is there something in the statute that I've missed?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not in the statute.
Okay. You're reading cause as proximately causes.
Yes, sir.
One of the proximate causes, not the sole proximate cause.
Yes, sir. The state represented that this fills a gap in the statute, a gap between lenient slap-in-the-hand punishment, as one of the legislators expressed it, and appropriate consequences for a serious act. We submit that's wrong. I'd ask the court to take a look at one of the cases that the state cites in its answering brief. Hazard versus State, a 1983 case. In that case, the defendant pulled out from a stop sign, a violation of 4164B, resulting in a fatal collision. As a result of that, the defendant was convicted of criminally negligent homicide. The court in 1983 said, on reviewing the motion for judgment of acquittal, said, indeed, the record is clear that the defendant's actions were criminally negligent. That was pulling out from a stop sign and failing to see an oncoming car, which resulted in a death. Now, the state is suggesting that they can't prosecute these cases. We're suggesting that they are prosecutable. And what was told to the legislature was not as wholly accurate insofar as this bill. And as a result, the legislature passed something, and I don't think they really understood the full ramifications of what were enacted, because this type of behavior was already prescribed, says under the law. In State versus Donato, a 1990 case, Judge Babiars, in an unreported decision, ruled on a motion for judgment of acquittal. In that case, the defendant was inattentive, traveling northbound on Interstate 95 near the bridge over the Christiana River near the port of Wilmington, and apparently he pointed to his wife something on the eastern side, maybe a ship in the harbor or whatever, and he didn't see that he was entering a construction zone, and the speed was reduced, and he rear-ended the vehicle in front of him, causing the death of a passenger in that vehicle. Mr. Donato was convicted of vehicular homicide second degree. And that conviction was affirmed, or excuse me, that conviction on motion for judgment of acquittal was denied by Judge Babiarz, who said, even though I may have decided differently, were I the fact finder, I would have, I am obligated because there's sufficient evidence to uphold this conviction. Now, the state is suggesting that these types of accidents couldn't be prosecuted under the former law. That is not accurate. State versus Kester, a case in 2001. I'm familiar with that case because I represented the defendant on appeal. A woman rear-ended a vehicle on Route 896 and Route 40 and caused the death of two passengers in the vehicle she rear-ended. She was convicted of two counts of vehicular homicide, and she was sentenced to imprisonment, I think at least a year and possibly up to 2 years. It wasn't impossible just to convict her. She was inattentive. She rear-ended the vehicle in front of her. It had a horrible consequence, and she was prosecuted and convicted under the vehicular homicide law.
What is the importance to us of the fact that these circumstances, in your view, could have been prosecuted even before this act was passed? This act has been passed. There are currently prosecutions taking place under it. Why should we reach the result you want us to reach? And I ask you that because you're in your rebuttal time.
The premise for the legislation was the legislature's understanding for the premise of the it was based on an inaccurate premise. And therefore, the legislature misunderstood what was happening.
How does that affect the decision we have to make? Is that a legal argument?
I mean, yes. How does it help us decide the case?
Pardon me?
How does it help us decide the case?
It helps us decide the case because it fits into how this prescribes punishment, significant punishment, for a state of mind that is not criminally culpable.
The difficulty is courts hold laws unconstitutional if they are. Courts don't say the law is unnecessary. So move away from the law is not necessary to the law is unconstitutional.
I understand. And the reason why it is unconstitutional, because it visits consequences of possibly serious criminal punishment on defendants because there wasn't an adequately culpable state of mind. And, you know, I'm running out of time. I'm going to skip. And it's that random result. Now, that's the problem. There was a reference in the legislative debates to the lottery, Shirley Jackson's short story. Now, Mr. Wallace said, well, he don't really understand the moral of it, and the legislature, Senator Copeland said he didn't really understand it too, but I think maybe we do all understand. And that's the problem with why this is unconstitutional, because it's punishment imposed based upon a lottery system, the random result of a traffic accident, the result having nothing to do with the state of mind. It's a lottery.
This lottery is unconstitutional. What is the state of mind, in your view, that is required to pass constitutional muster?
To pass constitutional muster? I would say criminal negligence, because in the past the state has prosecuted these cases under a criminal negligence standard, has achieved it.
Well, the statute as I read it says you look to the motor vehicle code, and if the motor vehicle code violation is based on carelessness or negligence, that's sufficient. That's the mens rea that applies. If it prescribes no element at all and isn't clearly strict if it isn't clearly a strict liability statute, then you look to see whether there's any other mens rea. If there's no other mens rea, then it has to be recklessness. But where the motor vehicle code states that the state of mind, or inferably the state of mind, is carelessness or negligence, that's sufficient under this statute. So where do we get the criminal negligence?
The criminal negligence? Because it's required to impose this type of penalty. And where you have a non-culpable state of mind, it's unconstitutional to impose this type of penalty.
But when you say non-culpable, are you talking strict liability or are you talking negligence? Because negligence is a culpable state of mind.
Strict liability. In negligence, there isn't any offense under the criminal code. There is a definition of negligence under the criminal code, but there's no offense where negligence is the standard for
talking about the motor vehicle code. That's what the statute talks about.
Well, under this statute, it doesn't even require it says negligence.
Well, I know you're running out of time, but I'm confused because it talks about operating or driving a vehicle that causes death when in the course of driving or operating you violate a provision of this chapter other than 4177. Now, that to me means the rules of the road. And other than a few strict liability rules of the road, all the other rules of the road imply negligence or above, mm-hmm. either stated explicitly or implied. So you would have a mens rea. You would have a degree of culpability. The legislature simply has lowered it as low as negligence rather than criminal negligence, which they already have a statute governing, or vehicular homicide, which usually involves recklessness. And they've specifically excluded driving under the influence here. So when you say it's non-culpable, is the term non-culpable consistent with negligence?
It's not. The punishment is not commensurate with the state of mind. That's what it comes down to.
Okay.
In addition to, may I make a point about the Delaware Constitution? Delaware Constitution, in 1897, if there was a carriage accident, if someone didn't yield to another carriage and it resulted in one carriage driver's carriage being overturned, there was a broken limb, later pneumonia, death. Well, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention of 1897 thought it appropriate or thought it conceivable to imprison the driver of the carriage for up to 30 months, or would they have considered that an actionable civil trespass and tort? I think it would have been incomprehensible to the delegates to the 1897 Constitution under due process that you could impose imprisonment under these circumstances.
Well, wasn't it a common law offense? Of manslaughter. Isn't that what State versus Huff is about?
I think that was where there was a commission of a misdemeanor, which resulted in a death, the misdemeanor manslaughter rule. I don't think a violation of some rule of the road or courtesy or a trespass in a carriage accident, would amount to a misdemeanor.
But isn't it fair that your argument has to be that as much as 30 months, mm-hmm. because for 37 years I've been practicing, careless driving has always had the potential of 10 days imprisonment. So it's not a question of imposing imprisonment for a violation of the rules of the road. It's the question of whether this degree of imprisonment is somehow unconstitutional.
Yes, and the state even represented the General Assembly that there wasn't any possibility of imprisonment. This man says here, Pritchett, I don't know whether 30 days was imposed, but he was subject to 30 days. Or not Pritchett, excuse me, the gentleman who was the defendant who caused Mr. Pritchett's death. And if you look at that situation, there's newspaper articles and there's a website also written by the victim's daughter describing the scene of an accident. That was a prosecutable offense of criminally negligent homicide or vehicular homicide. I don't know why it wasn't prosecuted as such. Now, the daughter of the decedent makes a reference in a website to why she thinks it wasn't prosecuted, but I don't think it had anything to do with lack of evidence.
Any other questions?
Just one. You started out saying the sentence was too long, and I assume that you're just going to rely on your references to Morissette in your brief?
Yes. Okay. I don't think I think that case answers the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Paul Wallace. I am here on behalf of the State of Delaware in answer to the certified questions. I don't think that I can disagree with Mr. O'Donnell any more about the vagueness argument that he makes. This statute simply isn't vague. It is very clear what it prohibits. It prohibits someone from violating our traffic code. Any of the violations in Chapter 41 of Title 21, those have been against the law forever. To say that that is vague would say that all of them are. But what it does, what this statute really does, is prohibits. It provides to sentencing judges an enhancement. If, in fact, that violation, that misdemeanor that was a misdemeanor before this statute, because all of Chapter 41 were unclassified misdemeanors before this. It's in the same title. It has not even been put in the criminal code. It gives those judges flexibility in sentencing in those circumstances.
Let me stop you right there. The statute says that the enhanced penalty is available if a person's driving or operation of the vehicle causes the death, not if the violation causes the death. And you've made the jump from one to the other, and I'd like to understand how you do that.
I think that's done, Your Honor, by 264 of Title 11, which speaks as to causation. Most of Chapter 41's violations are, in fact, strict liability offenses. Under the law, when that strict liability offense is created, it is per se negligence. That's how there is a state of mind, actually, that is inherent in this.
I'm not talking about state of mind. I'm talking about the scenario that I described to opposing counsel, where somebody's got a broken taillight, causes the death of a person who runs out into the street, is driving perfectly safely, and the broken headlight had absolutely no connection to the accident. But according to the statute, the person was driving or operating a vehicle that had a violation at the time, and the driving caused the death, so they're eligible under the statute.
We would suggest respectfully they're not, Your Honor.
Why?
Because you have to look at that second driving or operation in terms of in violation of Chapter 41 of Title 21. The state suggests, and that's why when we did our answering brief, that the elements of this crime are, as some members of the court have described it, a Chapter 41 violation, the death of another, and causation. That Chapter 41 violation has to be the cause. And I suggest 264 fills that in if the court does not.
But we've got clear language that says that the driving causes the death, not that the violation causes the death.
But it's driving in the course. It's in the course of driving or operating a motor vehicle in violation of Chapter 41.
If I understand you, you're saying we should read into that language, not the plain language that Justice Berger's pointing out, but we should read into that language something along the lines of that person's driving or operation in violation of any provision causes the death.
I suggest that is the appropriate reading of it. And perhaps
is the other side of the coin also true, and that is if someone's driving or operating a motor vehicle and does not violate any rule of the road, yet strikes another person and kills them, that would be left for a civil resolution?
Yes.
And be no criminal charges?
Absolutely. I'd suggest that the Chapter 41 violation has to be the cause. A cause, because that's how criminal law works, but that there has to be that causal link. And I'd suggest that 11 Delaware Code Section 264 is what really gives that link. I don't know that we're necessarily reading anything in. I think that we're looking at 264, because 264 indicates that when causing a particular result is an element of an offense for which strict liability is imposed, for instance, almost all of Chapter 41, except for perhaps careless driving and reckless driving, by law, the element is not established unless the actual result is a probable consequence of the actor's conduct. That's where the link is, Your Honor. It's in 264. There has to be a link, and there has to be a causation. We absolutely agree with that. That's the only way to constitutionally read this.
And 264 doesn't apply simply to strict liability. It applies to violations that require negligence before they constitute a violation?
Actually, if it's a negligence, then 263 actually applies, Your Honor, as this court found in Bullock. So 263 would be that which sets forth if there's negligence. There's actually, I'd suggest respectfully, very few of the Chapter 41 violations that define it as negligent. Maybe careless driving, because it talks about inattentiveness or carelessness. But really, they don't have a state of mind that says you negligently do X in Chapter 41. Most of them are strict liability offenses. You go through the stop sign.
Yeah, but these provisions that you're referring to in Title 11 apply to the application of this statute, because this is a separate criminal offense, is it not?
in the end, you have to call it a separate criminal offense. The reason it's drafted the way it is, the reason this couldn't just be a sentencing enhancement, is because of Apprendi. If this was simply drafted to be a sentencing enhancement that was put in Chapter 42, for instance, of Title 11, or Chapter 42 of Title 21, where sentencing issues are, what you would have is a fact that needed to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. You have an element of an offense. I mean, that's what Apprendi and its progeny told us. And therefore, what we had to do is draft a separate and distinct statute that had as an element causing the death. Otherwise, you end up in those Apprendi problems where you have to find it as an element. You're trying to take it out of a sentencing provision and put it in there. This, instead, puts it in one place at 4176A and indicates the actus for this crime, and it is a crime because 233 tells us it's a crime or offense.
If it is a separate crime, do you agree that the section itself does not speak to strict liability?
The section does not.
All right.
But none do. Actually, it's interesting, and if the court is going to the plainly appears language of 251, how much more plainly can it appear when you don't put a state of mind in it? How else can the drafters do it? In fact, if you look in the criminal code, if you look in Title 21, nowhere does it say, do it by plainly appearing by saying, this is a strict liability offense.
A person is guilty of possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony when he possesses a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. I mean, there are other statutes that don't talk about a state of mind to which a state of mind requirement it applies under 251.
Doesn't the code make it clear that if there is no state of mind prescribed and it can't be read clearly as an intention to impose strict liability, that recklessness is the mens rea that applies?
There are a couple of things that must be present there, and that's why, for instance, Justice Ridgely's situation with possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony isn't applicable. One, they can't be criminal statutes in Title 11. That's what 251 tells us. Strict liability offenses, when it says statutes outside this criminal code, that's why, for instance, in the possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony situation, it doesn't apply because it's in Title 11. It's within the criminal code. That's part of the reason this was put in Title 21.
How would it apply to this scenario? You're driving along and you hit a bump, and unbeknownst to you, a wire comes loose and your taillights are now out as a result of hitting this bump, even though when you started the car, you know, your taillights were on. Then you're rear-ended and someone's killed. So at the time you're operating your car, you're operating in violation of the motor vehicle law because you have no taillights, and the person's killed because they don't see your car, and they rear-ended and are killed. What's the state of mind, and is it relevant, and can you be prosecuted under this statute?
I suggest you could not, and because of 264. I would suggest respectfully that the taillights being out are not the probable consequence of that person's death. His death is not the probable consequence of the taillights being off. Something else had to happen. I mean, obviously, the other driver also has a duty. It's not your violation without the taillights that caused his death. More likely, it's his inattentiveness, unfortunately, in that circumstance. Those cases, you know, I would suggest there's not that link between the violation and the death. There isn't that causal link. It's not a probable consequence of the fact that your taillights are out. And that's why when when Hoover raised that, trying to find that causal link is truly impossible.
Has to be a cause, though, you said. It doesn't have to be the predominant proximate cause.
It has to be a cause, but more importantly, because that's how criminal law works, but more importantly, Your Honor, the death has to be the probable consequence of that act, and the probable consequence of your taillights being out is not that person's death.
Mr. Wallace, did I correctly understand you to be arguing that one of the reasons that number one, that Section 251 cannot be read on Section 4176.
I'm sorry.
That Section 4176 cannot be read in conjunction with Section 251. Is that part of your position?
Well, part of our position is, yes, that 251, what Hoover's position is, and for instance, in Adkins, the Superior Court found it was two other Superior Court judges did not believe that to be true. 251B, which is the substitute state of mind, is not applicable to 4176.
Because
it is a statute in Title 21 that is a strict liability offense. It plainly appears because there is no state of mind put there. It's outside the criminal code. That's what 251 permits. And to do so, what you would do...
Let me stop you there. You're arguing that because Section 4176 is outside the criminal code, that's at least one reason why Section 251 cannot apply and modify or to be used to interpret 4176. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay. Yet, at the same time, you argue that Section 264, which is also part of the criminal code, not only can be but must be read in order to import the causation requirement that you say is an essential part of a correct understanding of Section 4176, also outside of the criminal code.
And I think it's because of the specific language of 251 that is true, Your Honor. First of all, this court has in the past indicated that some of the general criminal provisions of Title 11 certainly apply in the prosecution of Title 21 offenses. Many of them do. 251C2 specifically says that it's unnecessary to prove a defendant's state of mind with regard to offenses defined by statute other than this criminal code. So it takes 251.
Finish it. It says, insofar as a legislative purpose to impose strict liability plainly appears. So the fair reading of that is, isn't it, that only it applies to other statutes other than the criminal code when anything other than strict liability is intended by the legislature?
Well, we would suggest that it does plainly appear in here because they do not put – they place it in Title 21 and they do not put a state of mind
attached to
it.
Then what would you do with careless driving where there is a state of mind?
Actually, the state suggests respectfully there isn't a state of mind. When careless driving says a person is guilty of careless driving when they fail to keep proper lookout or they drive inattentively or fail to keep proper lookout, it doesn't say the person negligently drives, the person drives with negligence. I suggest respectfully that it's not actually a state of mind crime. That's why earlier in the argument I had indicated, I honestly don't believe that there are states of mind in any of the Chapter 41 violations. There are ones that look akin. I mean, even reckless driving says person's guilty of reckless driving not when with a reckless state of mind they drive, but when they drive in willful or wanton disregard for the property of others.
And willful and wanton actions aren't a way of defining the term recklessness?
They are, but I'd suggest that that's not specifically talking about a state of mind. It's talking about the nature of their driving. It's talking about the nature of the act more than it's talking about anything
else. You reduce the concept of mens rea then to nothing but intentional conduct by that argument.
No, not at all, Your Honor. I'd suggest that
a certain way constitutes carelessness. How do you not impute that to a mens rea of negligence?
Well, we would suggest that just as the strict liability offenses, and if we want to look at careless driving and reckless driving, they do, because of the nature of the act and because of the way the person is acting, they do, for lack of a better term, substitute a specific state of mind in the statute. When the legislature looks at this, they see that all these Title 41 or Chapter 41 offenses are either things that are negligent per se under our law, and as all these have been interpreted, or if they have these, if the court wishes to call it a state of mind type offenses, they would be carelessness or greater if we had to say, okay, where do we pigeonhole this as a state of mind act? Careless driving would be criminally, if you were to try to pigeonhole it into Title 11 states of mind, careless, at least, maybe criminally negligent. If we took the willful or wanton disregard for the safety of others, how someone is acting at that time, it would be akin to recklessness. But they don't specifically prescribe a state of mind in those statutes. It's not consistent with the way we do it, for instance, in Title 11, where we say a person recklessly does X and causes X.
Is it accurate that, in looking at the Senate debate, I tried to find the word strict liability, and I only found it in that half the sentence that you made. It's not in the debate by the senators. They're not talking about it's our intent to enact a strict liability crime. That's my first question. And the second question is, was there a House debate? Because that's not attached. Address this in any way.
I do not believe there was a House debate, as I recall. I just honestly don't remember. I remember the Senate debate in particular because it raised many of the same questions that are raised here. But through the committee hearings and the debate, I'd suggest respectfully that legislators always understand, or at least deem to understand, what prior law is. And universally, motor vehicle offenses are considered strict liability offenses.
And they're presumed to understand 251 as well, right?
Yes. If this court were to read 251, say 251 applies to this statute, throw the statute out, it's no good, because it basically does nothing. In fact, it will then become harder to prove operation of a motor vehicle causing death than it will manslaughter.
If I understand your argument, that's not true at all. It would simply support what you've been telling us, because if we assume that you're accurate when you say that all the Title 21 offenses, but for 4177, are plainly strict liability statutes, and that negligence and carelessness are not synonymous, and that they don't impute a mens rea to whatever the number is for careless driving, I've sort of forgotten, 4176 maybe?
It's 4176, yes, Your Honor.
Well, but when 251C says that it's unnecessary to prove the state of mind when offenses defined by other statutes show a legislative purpose to impose strict liability, then all Title 21's covered, and it's perfectly consistent.
Yes. I'm sorry. I wasn't precise enough. If you say that 251C2 applies, which we suggest it does, then it's fine. What I'm saying is if you try to apply 251B, which says when there is no state of mind prescribed for criminal statute, then you have to say it's knowing, intentional, or reckless.
Well, apparently we're saying the same thing. It's dependent on us agreeing that all of Title 21 is strict liability.
At its core, yes. And I suggest respectfully that it is.
Before you sit down, at the risk of changing the subject for a moment, we've heard arguments and read in briefs that a subset of the vagueness unconstitutionality argument is the randomness or the fortuity of the imposition of the greater sentence, that whatever the action is, someone goes through a stop sign, doesn't hit anyone, no one sees them, nothing happens to them, they go through the stop sign, they hit and injure someone, they'll pay a fine for running the stop sign, and they'll probably see no other criminal action and be in a civil case with insurance coverage. But that very same act results in someone's death. That very same act causes someone's death. Then they're subject to 30 months in prison. If I understand the argument correctly, it is that that's so random in the way in which the same criminal activity imposes punishments that it is so vague and so fortuitous that it has to be unconstitutional, because it doesn't tell people in advance that the criminal act of running a stop sign will in all circumstances result in a reasonably precise sentence. Which I may not have articulated as well as the briefs or the appellant's argument, but that underlies it, and it's a seemingly troublesome argument.
Well,
why is that okay?
Because it happens all the time. In attempted murder, if the person fortuitously doesn't die, the person gets 15 years as opposed to life imprisonment. I mean, all acts come with possible consequences. To say that a driver doesn't know that he or she shouldn't run a red light because he may kill somebody is a random thing or is not something that people of the normal cane can understand would suggest that our roads are incredibly dangerous and nobody should drive today. People understand the act. They understand what they must not do. And we would suggest they now know that if they do it, they face a range of penalties. If they don't cause a specific result, if they don't kill someone, they face the Title 21 offense that merely may get them a fine or possibly a de minimis jail sentence. If they do that same act and the result is different, and all of criminal law is dependent on results, it depends on the nature of the act and the possibility of what the result may be. Driving is an inherently dangerous act. We're talking about people with a couple ton machines out there that can kill. Everybody knows from the time they take driver's ed that you don't speed because you may kill. You don't run through red lights because somebody may be coming the other way you can kill. Or in Mr. Hoover's situation, you don't go through a red light. Why? Because in the back of our heads is our mother's voice that says, you do that, you might kill someone. People understand that. Now, the result may, in fact, subject them to a higher sentence. By the way, it also may subject them to a lower sentence because at least there are minimum fines when you run that red light. In this, it gives a broad range to the judge. It says to the judge, do what is right with this person based on their act, based on the result, and based on the person's driving history. Let's take Mr. Hoover, for instance. Let's say, for instance, he's got a 4-page driving record. Without this statute, and I'd suggest that this is not an act of criminal negligence on his part. Mr. O'Donnell says, oh, the state can go ahead and prosecute him for criminally negligent homicide in these cases. That's not true, and we don't. And I don't think we would want to. What this does, it does give a middle ground. A Title 21 offense that's an unclassified misdemeanor, just like the red light ticket is when it doesn't cause death. But it gives some ability for the courts to look at what they are doing and determine what the appropriate range of sentence is. And quite honestly, we haven't seen a lot of jail time in these cases. In fact, I can't think of one who actually has gotten jail now. But what have judges been doing? They've been giving them probation. They've been telling them to talk to high school classes. They've been doing those types of things.
All these cases were stayed. Are you talking about?
I'm talking about the history of sentences, yes. They're stayed now. But we now have 4 years of having this law on the books, so we have seen some trending in sentencing.
And you're telling us no one has ever gotten jail time?
No, I'm not saying no one has. I can't think of one off the top of my head. But I'd suggest that we've seen sentences in the probation range. I think, in fact, I believe that's what the Sentac guidelines call for.
Well, it's fair to say the reason you wouldn't prosecute someone for criminally negligent homicide is it's a whole lot easier to prosecute somebody under this statute. You face much less of a burden.
But the reality of it is that quite honestly, Mr. Hoover would not have been prosecuted for criminally negligent homicide. He would not. That was a case that we would say, that's not criminal negligence to run through a red light.
Well, you do agree that criminal negligence has a mens rea, and you'd have to prove it. But here you don't have to prove a mens rea.
We do not have to prove a mens rea. Instead, we have to prove that they engaged in an act that our legislature has said is inherently dangerous. And the reality, Your Honor, on, for instance, criminally negligent, how can a statute that says it is a felony to, with criminal negligence, cause the death of somebody, be less vague than if you commit certain acts and kill someone? How can criminally negligent homicide be less vague? And yet, it certainly passes constitutional muster. This statute passes constitutional muster. It was well conceived by the legislature, we would suggest. It was well debated. That's part of the reason we put the debate in there.
Was the statute based on similar statute in any particular state?
I know during the research phase that we looked at many. There were many considerations, quite honestly, some very draconian, that wanted to make vehicular homicide third and make it a felony and things like that. That's why it was designed the way it was. We looked at many of the states. We did look at, for instance, places like Idaho and Connecticut. We looked at Pennsylvania's, where it was struck down in Heck. That had a 5-year sentence. We thought that that was much overboard as far as the possible sentencing for a first-time offender. And so there was research done on other states. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Donnell, I know that you've run out of time, but this is an important case, and the court's agreed to give you 3 minutes rebuttal if you want it. Now, both arguments went in the red, so I think we've concluded it's fair to do this. And just watch the reverse clock.
I understand. I'll try to take all the 3 minutes. I'd just like to make a few points. One, the state claims it's not vague because it's no more vague than prosecuting someone for not seeing a stop sign or anything else. The problem with that is that what if the state came in here with a statute that said, okay, 4176A, the punishment shall be up to death. Is there a problem with that? We submit that illustrates the problem with this. Could the state walk in here and say the punishment can be up to death for disregarding says a red light? Now, under those circumstances, the state could get all the pleas it wanted to criminally negligent homicide, vehicular homicide, second degree, manslaughter. If that was true, that's the mechanism that's at play here. The state also points out that, well, it's bound by all these limitations in its prosecution. And it's not just the statute. There are other types of limitations. I'd ask the court to consider and look at Adkins' case, what Judge Young struggled with. The same thing that Mr. Wallace is saying that he'd be bound by and restricts his prosecution of these cases, Judge Young recognized in Adkins. Adkins was the case that the legislature was concerned about would be prosecuted, and there was a suggestion it wouldn't be, and it is, just like the Stinichin case, and just like the Win Wang case at Kirkwood Highway, where both drivers are charged with killing one person, both drivers of the two different vehicles. The third point I'd like to make is that the state suggested that, well, these really aren't people aren't sentenced very severely under this, and the 30 months is, well, that it doesn't happen. The Statistical Analysis Center did a study of all the cases up through October 2007. 51 cases were prosecuted from the beginning of this bill to October 2007. 8 defendants of the 51, or 15.7%, received level 5 sentences. Others up from up to 114 days to, well, it's just not accurate that people aren't being sentenced to imprisonment terms, that they're being told to talk to schools about driver safety, et cetera. People can be sentenced to imprisonment under this, and it's not an innocuous penalty for an offense they can't predict they will face that penalty.
Mr. O'Donnell, what is your response to the state's argument that Section 251C2 carves out this statute from the operation of Section 251B?
Well, it would be offenses defined by statutes other than this criminal code insofar as legislative purpose to impose strict liability for such offenses. I would suggest, first of all, that the legislature from the debate didn't realize it was imposing strict liability. And the language of the statute permits that, says the vagueness of the statute, permits the legislature to understand it wasn't imposing strict liability. And secondly, if that's so, if you can get a way of the notion of culpability to or state of mind to impose imprisonment term, fine, we can move a lot of criminal defenses to some other title besides Title 11. You know, make disregarding a red light a sentence of death. So long as you move it over to Title 21 rather than Title 11, we have no problem here. If 251C2 is literally
applied as the state suggests.
Well, the state is arguing that it plainly appears from the face of 4176A that the legislature intended to impose strict liability. If that's the case, then that carve-out eliminates your 251 argument, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so, because I think, first of all, the legislation, it's not plain from the legislative debate or the language of the statute
that
strict liability is intended.
Okay, tell me why it's not plain from the language of the statute.
That's from the language of the statute, because in violation of any provision of this chapter, the person's driving or operation of the vehicle causes the death of another person. If you're driving, you're driving or operating a vehicle. If you're violating a statute, you're violating a statute. If there's a proximate cause, if that driving and the motor vehicle violation results in death, you're culpable under the statute. That's the way I read it, and the way it can be applied. Look at Atkins.
Well, that's strict liability, isn't it?
Yes.
So the statute does, it plainly appears that the legislature did intend to impose strict liability.
Well, I don't think so. It says based upon, says the legislative, says debate. It's very clear. And once you do apply strict liability under this circumstance, you get to the constitutional question of imposing drastic consequences.
In order to, for us to accept your argument, we have to rely on the debate and not the text of the statute.
The state put it out there. I'm asking the court to consider it.
Yeah, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.